House Judiciary to order. It's 2:15, and it's the 24th of February, and we do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Representatives Coghill, Wilson, Gruenberg, and myself, McGuire. We have five items on the agenda today, and they will go in this order. House Bill number 329 on bail restrictions by Representative Stoltz will bring back up with a new committee substitute to adopt. Then we're going to go to House Bill 446, penalty for unlawful trade practices. It's my bill, and Ted Popley's presenting it, which is such an honor. And then we're going to have therapeutic courts, will be third, House Bill 441, Ms. Nobrega. And then we're going to go to House Bill 93, dentist and dental hygienists. We're not sure why that bill's in this committee, but then we're going to go to House Bill 414, interception of minors' communications, and get a start on that bill. Okay, so without further ado, we've got House Bill 329, Representative Gruenberg.
Could we go off the record for a minute?
Sure, we'll take a brief at ease. It's 2:20. Okay, and so when we went off the record, we were bringing up House Bill 329. We have a committee substitute, Representative Coghill.
329?
Yeah. Version Y, I think it is.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Then I would ask that move that we have the CS, House CS for House Bill 329, version Y, before us as our working document.
Okay, is there an objection to adopting version Y? Okay, hearing none, we have version Y properly before us. Tell us about it.
For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff to Representative Bill Stoltz. After the last committee meeting yesterday, we went back and revised some of the sections, and now what it'll do is it'll still allow the court to temporarily or periodically release a defendant for a death of an immediate family member or for the birth of their child. This will apply for people for misdemeanors and then up to B and C felons, leaving the harshest ones without that option. And then also on the last page, you'll see we also inserted that the court, you know, solicit information from the Department of Corrections on their behavior while incarcerated and consider that information.
Good. Okay, discussion. I don't have any discussion.
Do you? Sure, I think that takes care of the questions we had yesterday, so I would move that
There's one amendment?
The version that we have before us is the amendment, basically.
No, but there's another amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Representative Guerra had drafted an amendment, and I had offered it as a courtesy to offer it.
Okay.
And what I would like to know is, we've got Department of Law people here who are nodding, smiling, and cringing slightly, and we've got the sponsor who's smiling broadly. Is there a problem with the amendment? I know it may not totally be necessary, but it may provide a little clarification.
I'll object to the amendment so I can hear what he wants.
Yeah.
Just to keep protocol going, Madam Chair.
Chair, Representative Gruenberg. After talking with my boss and Department of Law and Department of Corrections, they feel there is no problem with the amendment, and we'd be happy to have it in there.
I'd ask unanimous consent.
I just want to hear.
So what it does, I think.
Well, it's not satisfied bail.
I think it's clear, but if it makes them feel more comfortable and if you have no objection, then it's fine.
I'll remove my objection, Madam Chair.
Okay, so amendment number one, the objection's been removed. Any further objection to amendment number one? So hearing none, amendment number one carries, which brings us back to Representative Coghill's motion.
I'm sure I would move that we move House Bill 329 as amended from committee with individual recommendations, and I don't, yes, there is an attached zero fiscal note.
Okay, any objection to that motion? Okay, so House Bill 329 as amended with individual recommendations has moved.
I would just like to thank the sponsor and the folks from Law and Corrections for working with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz, and thank you to your staff.
Thank the chairman for getting this ahead of her impending baby, and I want to wish you good luck back home.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you. Okay, so House Bill 446, Mr. Popley's here to help us. From my perspective, I'll just start and then let him go into it. We were approached by Mr. Sniffen, who is our state consumer rights advocate. He's in the Department of Law, and this has been a personal passion of his for many years. And as the members of the committee know, through the years, we've been taking steps to tighten up our consumer protection laws and to try to send a really strong message that we don't tolerate that in Alaska. And we continue to top the nation in fraud complaints. And so this bill is a step in that direction. Mr. Popley's here. Mr. Johnson, my chief of staff, left on a plane today. And so he's stepping into his shoes. And so he's here as well. Mr. Popley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ted Popley with Legislative Council. It's an honor to be here to talk about this bill. 446 simply increases the available penalties that the Department of Law may avail itself of under the Consumer Protection Act. Currently, the law permits civil penalties to be sought by the Department of Law and the Attorney General in cases of consumer fraud, consumer deception, other acts forbidden under the Alaska Consumer Protection Act. Those civil penalty provisions have been in place since the act was originally enacted in 1970. They're rather low in comparison to other states. They're extremely low considering that they haven't moved in Alaska since that time. As the sponsor statement indicates to you, even without an increase, just simply adjusting for the cost of real dollars in inflationary terms, the figures are a very modest increase. And as Representative McGuire indicated, the Department of Law Consumer Protection Unit utilizes these civil penalties as a tool to enforce our consumer protection laws against companies that may defraud Alaskan consumers. There are two sections that are being modified. The first one, under Section 1, page 1, line 7, increases the available civil penalty from $25,000 per violation to $50,000. That is provided for situations where a company has been served with an injunction against further deceptive practices. When that injunction is violated and the company continues to act in a manner that has been enjoined, the Department of Law Attorney General may move for civil sanctions in the amount of $50,000, currently written as $25,000. The second section on page 2, section 2, currently the civil penalty available for simply violating a provision of the consumer protection law and having adequately been demonstrated by the Attorney General, he may move for civil penalties, currently up to $5,000 per violation. The amended amounts under this bill would set a new range between $1,000 and $25,000 per violation. Those are the critical terms of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. There are members here from the Consumer Protection Division of the Department of Law online. I hope Cindy Drinkwater is here in case you had any questions for her as well. Mr. Sniffen's unavailable. He's traveling today.
Thank you. Representative Groomer.
If Ms. Drinkwater or somebody's online, I'll ask her the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Popley, for the questions. Appreciate it. Okay, Ms. Drinkwater.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Little louder if you could. Please.
How's that? Is that better?
Much better. Thank you. Do you have prepared remarks, Ms. Drinkwater, or are you just available for questions?
I'm available for questions.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg has a question for you.
Thank you. I really have three, and one of them I had circulated a memo from Legal on. I'll get to that third. But the others I didn't really think about until just a minute ago. The other two questions, the first two questions I'll ask, relate to Section 1 of the bill. And its current language that's not affected by the bill itself. It's AS 5551A. And where it says, first, that the cause shall be continued That seems to be ancient language, because a continuance now implies that you don't act on something, you get a continuance before trial. And I'm wondering, do we need to have the phrase, and the cause shall be continued? It seems to me it's enough to simply say that the court retains jurisdiction. What do you think, Ms. Drinkwater?
Senator Gruenberg, through the chair, I would agree that that language probably is unnecessary.
Okay, I'll make an appropriate motion at the appropriate time, Madam Chair. The second question, at the last line, is the Attorney General, blah, 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 may petition for recovery of the penalties. That could be read as requiring the court, the AG, to petition the court for a writ of execution or get a special order. I don't think we need that, because all they have to do, I would think, is to obtain a writ of execution. Isn't that the case?
Again, Senator Gruenberg, through the chair, the way that we request civil penalties typically is initially in the complaint itself. Then, of course, the case moves along through the court system through, you know, summary judgment or trial or however it proceeds. And then once there's a judgment, we ask for civil penalties. Or once it's at the point of being ready for seeking a final judgment, we apply for civil penalties through a motion for civil penalties. So my interpretation of the word petition here would be a little bit broader, I think, than what you're suggesting, and that we are just requesting the court for civil penalties.
Oh, so you're not talking about the writ of execution, you're talking about the motion for the penalties.
That's correct.
Is that language drafted properly, or do you think it should say move the court, or do you like the language?
Representative Gruenberg, just to clarify, in both your discussion points, you're referencing existing statutory language.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Do you think that the word petition is correct, or should we say move the court?
Well, I have not seen it as a problem as it's drafted, although it may be a little bit unclear. But.
Well, I'm not going to worry about it then if it's not a problem. And the other thing, as I assume you want to take the amendments at the end, I had wondered whether the Section 3, the applicability subsection, would cause an ex post facto problem here in the constitutional sense. And our alleged legal counsel had stated in a memo dated today to me, happy to fax it to you, that the applicability provisions of Section 3 may be subject to a constitutional ex post facto challenge. And he concludes, in conclusion, I do not know how this issue would be resolved by a court. However, the applicability section you propose, that means proposed in the bill, changes the penalty for events that have already occurred. The fines are designated as a penalty. It would be difficult to argue that the fines are compensatory rather than punitive. And if they're punitive, the ex post facto could apply. If they're compensatory, they wouldn't. This would seem to run afoul of the ex post facto prohibition. It seems to me that, Ms. Drinkwater, that we have three choices. We can leave the language as is and allow the parties to brief the issue if anybody raises it and let the court decide it. We could strike Section 3, or we could put in some other language. If we leave it the way it is, knowing that there's at least a possibility of a problem, would you be prepared to defend it?
Senator Gruenberg, perhaps I could defer to Mr. Popley if he's still available. Mr. Sniffen did also conduct an analysis of that issue, and I think he came to a different conclusion. And I would just ask if Mr. Popley wants to address that, or if you prefer that I address it.
And Ted, if you could refer to him as Senator Gruenberg, please.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm a representative. Don't demote me, please.
By the way, Heath is taping. I asked him to tape for Lisa and I because she's pregnant and we wanted the baby to see this. And if you could not tape all on Max because we'll run out of tape. I looked at Heath taping with Max. I'm like, God, the kid's going to say, that's what you guys do? Who's that man? Well, that's your uncle's son. He's still alive, and he's 130, and he's still in the room talking.
And don't get my body, they'll think I'm pregnant. But
Mr. Buckley.
Uncle Ted on the day, too. Go ahead.
Actually, that reminds me of a famous story, if I can digress.
Sure.
Mr. Popley, do you want to answer that or have her answer?
Sure. I'd be pleased to. Ted Popley, through the chair, Representative Grunberg. Ms. Drinkwater's right. I did speak to Ed Sniffen about this before he left town because I knew it was a potential issue. Anytime you have an applicability section that's other than the effective date of the act, it, of course, is going to raise the issue of whether or not there's an ex post facto issue. And that's why Mr. Bailey raised that in his memorandum. As he stated, it's unclear how the
I don't know that we have that memo.
Well, in his opinion, I don't know if you do either.
Maybe I do. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
In my discussions with him, he raised it as a potential issue, as you have. But, you know, I talked to Ed Sniffen about that. He did some research on it for me as well. And there are a couple of points to make. One, his opinion is definitively he does not think it's an ex post facto problem for several reasons. One, generally ex post facto challenges are directed at purely punitive actions. And as you raise, Mr. Bailey talks about whether this is compensatory or punitive in nature. It's really a hybrid of both. It's a civil penalty. It's designed to do more than just punish. It's designed to compensate as well. Ex post facto challenges are generally most successful when they deal with purely criminal acts and criminal violations. The Consumer Protection Act itself, of course, is not a criminal statute. This is not. We're not talking about companies who are being charged with crimes or individuals. We're talking about companies who are being essentially sued by the Attorney General for damages because of deceptive practices. The conduct that may be challenged remains impermissible under statute regardless of what happens with the civil penalty changes affected by this bill. The conduct will have already been illegal at the time any penalties are assessed. There's no new criminal or civil liability for a company. They're simply altering the amount of liability under the statute. No substantive rights are being denied by increasing the amount of the penalty as well. And those are all factors that the court generally looks at when it makes an ex post facto analysis. More importantly, in talking with Ed Sniffen, who is head of the Consumer Protection Unit, the point about putting this retroactivity provision in there, as you mentioned earlier, you could simply eliminate it or you could leave it in there and allow the court to rule on it if and when it's challenged. I believe there are only a handful of cases that are out there pending that would be impacted by this after the effective date of this act. In other words, the retroactivity provision would only apply to those cases that are pending now.
Not necessarily.
Well, in other words, new cases after the effective date of this act, should it pass, wouldn't be impacted by that.
Not necessarily.
Representative Grunberg?
Because let us say you got somebody out there, the Ajax company, violating the Consumer Protection Act left and right. And nobody even knows about it. But at some point within the next statute of limitations, they bring the action, and then the trial occurs. It would certainly apply to that because the assessment occurred.
That's true. That's true. Any conduct, I suppose, within the statute of limitations period is,
yes,
I guess, what I meant. That's true.
Yeah.
I think the bigger question is more of a practical one because they think you can make valid arguments on either side. Mm-hmm. So the real question is, this is being brought by me on behalf of the fraud unit. And so if they're willing to take the chance and the risk and would like this as an extra tool in their tool belt, mm-hmm, I think we ought to leave it in and,
yeah,
and go forward.
Yeah.
There's no downside to it. And the upside may be that it means more money to the state based on these existing cases and some which we may not know of yet where the conduct's already occurred. So
yeah, and
those are sound arguments in response.
And, so, and that's my feeling, yeah, too, and it certainly is a good bargaining. Chip.
That's exactly right. It demonstrates legislative intent.
As long as they're willing to defend it, I'm not going to move in. So I just have one amendment then.
Okay, so let me just finish. Steve Cleary is the only other person to testify, so I can go ahead and close out public testimony, and then we'll take the amendments. Mr. Cleary.
Thanks, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Steve Cleary. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, ACPIRG, and I'm here just to echo all the great things that have been said so far about this bill. I really want to thank the sponsor and the committee for dealing with this today. It's going to be a great way to modernize consumer protection here in Alaska. ACPIRG was founded about the same time that these original laws were put in place, and we've gone through a lot of modernization, and it's good to know that the laws are about to be updated as well. I must confess my ignorance to the fact that I didn't even know that these laws had gone and changed for so long. So kudos to sponsor Representative McGuire and the Department of Law for bringing this to our attention. It's going to be something that the Department of Law can use in their tool belt, and along with some identity theft legislation that's moving through the Senate and should arrive to your committee quite soon, I hope. Consumers have a good reason to be cheered on by work that this legislature is doing this year. So full support of this, and the 2,000 members of ACPIRG around the state will be gratified to know that the legislature is taking steps to better consumer protection here in our state. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? Anybody online that I've overlooked? Okay, so public testimony is closed. Brings House Bill 446 back before us. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer the following amendment, which is not in writing. On page 8, strike 8 and 9, page 1, lines 8 and 9, excuse me. Strike the phrase, "and the cause shall be continued, comma, for the reasons we've discussed."
Mr. Popley, do you see any problems with that?
I'll object for discussion purposes.
I think it's just a matter of phraseology. I suppose what we could do is accept the amendment, and then if Mr. Sniffen, when he returns, that I always feel a little uncomfortable when it's an underlying statute because it's been working, and if the person utilizing it, Mr. Sniffen, had concerns, I assume he would have brought them forward. So I hate to tinker with something that's working.
Yeah, just ask
Representative Coghill,
the maker of the amendment. Certainly a motion of continuation is one thing, but a continued matter certainly would be another. Am I wrong?
That's not the modern terminology. We see this occasionally in a statute from pre-statehood. This is ancient language, and I absolutely agree with what Ms. Drinkwater said. And I would offer this with the understanding that if Mr. Sniffen has any problem with it, it can be reinserted back in finance or elsewhere on the floor anywhere.
Certainly, Madam Chair, I think the fact that the district retains jurisdiction would mean that they would be able to continue in an action, I think so.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so amendment number one, there was an objection. Is the objection maintained?
No.
Okay, so the objection's been removed. Is there any further objection to amendment number one? Okay, hearing none, amendment number one carries. Further amendments, Representative Gruenberg?
No.
Okay, so that brings House Bill 446 as amended before us. Representative Coghill.
Chair, I move that we move House Bill 446 as amended, debated from committee with individual recommendations, and looks like no fiscal. Oh, yeah, there is a zero fiscal note.
I'd just like to note for the record, I've asked Mr. Popley to distribute that memorandum on the ex post facto issue to us for our files, so we'll have two legal memos on this, and I think that's important to have that in the record in our files. Thank you.
The motion on the table, is there an objection to the motion of moving House Bill 446 as amended? Okay, hearing none, House Bill 446 moves. Thank you, Mr. Popley. Thank you, Mr. Cleary and Ms. Drinkwater. Oh my gosh, this committee is running so smoothly today. I wish it was always like this. Okay, next up, we have therapeutic courts. Ms. Norwega, House Bill 441. Welcome to House Judiciary.
Well, thank you.
Everybody say hello to Heather.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. For the record, I'm Heather Nabriga, staff to Representative Rochberg, who could not be here because he's up in resources, where I'm sure you're all dying to be right now.
Yes.
As I'm sure you all are aware, because you've all been on judiciary for a while now, therapeutic courts are important to the state of Alaska, and we've made lots of improvements towards the working of therapeutic courts. We've had statutory changes, and we have our existing pilot court program that was first started in 2001, which is actually expiring here this June. So we thought it'd be a good opportunity to take the pilot program, what's in statute, meld them together, and make a great statutory structure for for therapeutic courts in Alaska. So that is what House Bill 441 is attempting to do. And I would certainly, in a nutshell, I mean, I would certainly be happy to answer any questions, but we have lots of the professionals here behind me that would be probably better able to answer any technical questions you might have about the substance of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Nobrega. And there is a sectional analysis in the bill packet. And we have two folks to testify. We have Doug Woolover from the courts. Doug, you want to come forward, Mr. Woolover? And then we have Ronald Taylor. And that's all I have. So if you're looking to testify on House Bill 441, sign up. Mr. Woolover.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Doug Woolover, administrative attorney for Alaska Court System. As Heather said, we'd like to put the conditions of House Bill 172 from 2001 into statute. That was our pilot program. We'd like to keep our therapeutic courts going. This bill does that. I think you're all familiar with the benefits of those courts. I can tell you that this bill will likely evolve over time as we move from this committee to the next and the next, and we'll be working with the Department of Law, the therapeutic court judges, the Public Defender Agency, Department of Corrections, ASAP, and everybody else who works in this area to make some changes. After working under the conditions terms of House Bill 172 for a number of years, there are a number of kind of changes we'd all like to see made, but we'll be working with everybody to do that, and we think this is a good start, and we support this bill.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Woolover?
You do support.
Representative Groomberg.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Okay. And next I have Mr. Taylor. Online?
Yes, Madam Chair.
There you go. Go ahead and testify.
Well, actually, I was just going to be available for questions if there were any. From ASAP or the Department of Health and Social Services.
Questions from the committee? Okay, we don't have any at this time. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on House Bill 441? Anybody online that I've overlooked? Okay, hearing none, public testimony is closed. It brings the bill back before us. Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, before I move the bill, I just want to state for the record that and I've worked with Doug and others, that the therapeutic court model is not only innovative, but having worked with the industry and folks that have gone through the system, it's really a better design, in my opinion, than incarceration. I know we all agree, but I think it's always good for the record to state that, because it's something that needs to be funded adequately and to be continued on. And I know there's been some derivatives and some changes over the last 2 years, whether it be the drug court or the DUI drinking court. I think that these are really, really worthy programs to fund and to support. So I'm glad that Representative Rochberg sponsored the legislation.
Thank you to the bill's sponsor. If you can relay back to him, this has been a personal interest of his, and he's made great strides and continued through the years to keep it going. And I think it's truly made a difference. I know in our community in Anchorage it has, and I know it's expanded to other parts of the state. So thank you for the work, and we look forward to seeing how the bill progresses. So with that, is there a motion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 441 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, 441 moves. That brings us to House Bill. Are we ready for House Bill? Let's take a brief at ease.
Madam Chair.
It's 10-3, and we have House Bill. We're going to take up House Bill 414 next. And we have a representative of the bill sponsor here. Tell us about the bill.
Madam Chairman, good afternoon, members of the committee. Mike O'Hare, staff for Representative Pete Cott. Representative apologized for not being here today, but he asked me to introduce the bill to committee. HB 414 is about protecting kids from insalubrious characters and predation. Our children today are a lot more sophisticated with cell phones, internet access, chat lines, and communicating with each other. Currently, if two people, if two people are talking on the telephone, it is legal for one of the party to record the conversation. If my child is speaking to an individual of questionable character, it is currently illegal for myself as a parent to intercept that communication and proceed with a court proceeding against this individual. HB 414 makes it legal for parents of a minor to intercept these communications. It also allows for a parent, if they're acting in good faith in the best interest of the child, to give consent to the authorities to intercept communications via court order. While the sponsor recognizes the potential weakness for the privacy issue and that our state has a special interest in the right to privacy, we feel that it is a contention that is not the absolute right when the state has a compelling interest to take care of our kids. What this bill basically does in Section 1, it allows the parents or guardians of a minor in good faith and based on an objectively reasonable belief that it is necessary for the welfare of the child, of the minor, and in the best interest of the minor, to petition the court for an ex parte order, and if granted, the police would then conduct a wiretap. It also allows a parent or guardian of a minor to intercept a communication between a minor and a third party, unless it involves an attorney or a guardian ad litem of the minor. And then finally, it defines a minor as a child under the age of 18 who is not emancipated. And also it defines a parent as a person who is not prohibited by the court from communicating with the minor and is the minor's natural or adoptive parent or the minor's legally appointed guardian. Excuse me, Madam Chairman. We have an amendment to that to add the definition of a parent, and I believe you have that in your packets.
What version of the bill?
Yes, thank you. Before us, we have version F, the HESCS.
Okay. Representative Clarkell?
I think we have the Y version that has that language about the parent in it. So it
they're not offering that.
Okay.
They've chosen to offer chosen, the HESCS.
That's correct.
So that means what version?
Version F. With Hess.
I am available for questions. We have Ann Carpenade from the Criminal Division and Ted Popley, again, to answer any legal questions we may have, and I'm available for questions.
And the bill's drafter is also online as
thank
well.
You. Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
If I may say something one more.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg and I had a lively conversation this morning, and we also recognize the issues that that this bill may impact with regards to divorce proceedings and child custody proceedings. Again, while we recognize that and the right to privacy, we feel that it is in the best interest of the kids to take care of them, especially if, as parents, we are held responsible for their actions. We would like the tools to take good care of them and monitor their activities. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. O'Hare. And Representative Guerra has joined us for the record some time ago. Representative Guerra.
Yeah. So I understand the need for the bill and the concern the bill raises. To minimize it, I'm wondering, you've got this definition of a parent, but what happens when you've got divorced parents or parents who have split custody and the parent who doesn't have custody wants to listen in to a conversation while the kid is in the other parent's custody? I mean, is that something we should think about? It's really they're not listening in really necessarily for the welfare of the child, but maybe to I don't know, maybe listening to a communication, well, I suppose I just don't want bitter parents to start who are sharing custody to use the child as a pawn and start listening to conversations in that circumstance, but I don't know if that would occur.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, it certainly might occur the way is being interpreted right now. If you look at page 3, line 30, the ninth exemption is the interception of a private communication to which a minor is a party or by a parent or guardian of the minor, except that the interception of a private communication between a minor and the minor's attorney or guardian ad litem is not exempt from the provisions. If we would like to add, if it also like to add to that, you know, if it is in good faith and based on the objectively reasonable belief that is necessary for the welfare of the minor, that would hopefully clear up some of these issues. Again, in those circumstances, all of the activities are in the best interest of the minor and can be argued, and we would encourage those arguments to be argued in court, sir. That's all right.
Representative Coughlin.
Just a thought. One of the things that we do in some of our terms of art in divorce issues is decide who is the custodial parent, and should we maybe reference that here? Because we're talking about a natural or adoptive, maybe we should say natural, adoptive, or custodial parent, which gives them the right to manage that custody properly. So just a thought.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill.
If you have natural or adoptive, you might have, you say natural, common, adoptive, or custodial parent. And I think at that point we could deal with the estranged family issue.
Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, I really looked at this for the first time last night. And this is going to be opening up a significant problem, as I mentioned to Mr. O'Hare. The question in custody cases and divorces arises from time to time when one parent wants to tape record the conversations with the other parent. And starting about 10 or 15 years ago, the question arose whether this was an illegal federal act under the Federal Wiretapping Act. And the scenario usually goes like this. There is a hot custody case going on. It may be in the context of divorce or may not. Maybe a motion to change custody post-divorce. And the one person tape records the other parent's conversations with the child, or it may be between the child and a sibling or somebody else. And then the other parent learns about this when they attempt to introduce the tape or a transcript of the tape at the trial. And that's usually followed by a motion for a protective order, and then followed by a lawsuit in federal court in the most vicious cases. They move from state court to federal court. These cases go on for years. And then the person's not satisfied at the district court level and goes to the Federal Court of Appeals. And there are a growing number of decisions from the Federal Court of Appeals as to whether the Federal Wiretapping Act permits it or prohibits it. And the majority, as I recall when last I looked, was that most federal courts permitted it. They said it was not a violation. There was a domestic relations exception was what it amounted to. But I have been successful in getting a transcript in one case that I had in Superior Court in Anchorage. I think that's the only time I ever did it. And the question was whether it was illegal, and I argued, well, whether it's illegal or not, that doesn't have anything to do with whether it's admissible in this proceeding. This is not like the criminal area, where you have the exclusionary rule that if something's illegally obtained, it's inadmissible. That doesn't apply in the civil sphere. The family law is just procedures not conducted like that. And the judge agreed and let it in. But now They're starting, it looks like, with this bill, and I understand one other state, possibly Georgia, has done it, nobody else that I know of, trying to get around the question of the federal, or deal with the federal issue by saying, well, the question is, should it be legal or illegal under state law? And so this is not, in the 99% of the cases, this is going to be used by warring parents against each other to tape record kids' calls. And I am concerned, just as a practical matter, because any good divorce lawyer worth their salt, if they know that it's going to be allowed and can be used against them, will advise their client to tape every single telephone call so that it's not redacted and edited and comes out something that's wrong on the other side. You're sure you have a complete record, and then you tape record the kid's phone calls with the other side, see if you can use it against them. That is, this is going to take on a different dimension in family law cases. And the child should be able to freely talk privately with their parents and with their siblings unless there's a really good reason why not. Because otherwise, the next thing that the lawyer is going to advise their child is don't say anything on the phone that you don't want used in court. If you want to talk to me, let's go talk privately where they can't overhear us. And this will be used as part of the divorce strategy. And the kid will be put right in the middle of the custody battle, and the courts generally try to keep the child out. That's why they don't have kids testify in court. That's why they don't talk to the kids in chambers. I've only had one case where a judge talked to a child in chambers, and that's why she said she wanted to live with the dad, and the judge took her in the chambers and found out the reason she wanted to live with the dad was he promised her a pony. And, of course, he didn't get very far with that. So my suggestion to Mr. O'Hare and my suggestion to the committee is we need to hear testimony from the family law practitioners on this. And I'm also, with the leave of the committee and the sponsor, Mr. O'Hare, I'd like to contact the ABA Family Law Section and the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. They have committees that deal with this, so we get a little expert testimony on this from around the country. This is not primarily a criminal issue. It's going to be used by warring parents. And I'm talking about the last section. The first section, which has you go get a court order, and it's used in criminal law, I think may be a little easier, but I want to be sure that it's not going to be misused and putting the children right in the middle of these divorces.
Do you have any comments,
Again, Madam Chairman, Representative Grunberg, the sponsor's intention is to protect children. We realize that through our conversations with Representative Grunberg, the possibilities of snowballing in a divorce or child custody issue will be involved. Our contention is that this is for the best interest and these of the child, and the parents are acting in good faith. Now, it does not say that in that last section. We would certainly be willing to insert that into that last section. If it is the wish of the committee to research this further, then so be it.
What prompted, if I can ask, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but what prompted the bill? Was there a circumstance that...
Initially, there was a child custody circumstance where the parent found out that the child was being emotionally abused by the other parent. And recorded the conversation and found out that it was potentially illegal to do so. It is illegal to do so, excuse me. And then, as a parent, the sponsor said, wait a minute. It's illegal for me to look over my child. What if the what if started to snowball? What if my child is on the phone with a predator? Is it truly illegal for me to to record these communications in order to take care of my child, or even if I, as a parent, am responsible for the activities of my child, criminally, civilly, whatever. I want to know if my child is in trouble or not, and I want to take care of them. So it went from there, but initially it was a child custody matter.
My mom snooped around my room and probably listened to all my phone calls. Yep. I didn't know it was illegal. Wish I would have known.
Madam Chairman.
You now know the baby.
I'm not telling my child that. He's going to think it's totally legal.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, in the previous committee, one of the members said, I can't believe I've been doing these illegal activities all these years.
Did they tell you which illegal activities they were talking about?
The chair, I'm not even going to mention the members.
I'm going to mention the name. Comments from the committee or questions? Have you talked with Representative Cott about this at all?
Our conversations were this morning,
why don't we do this? On Senate Bill 20, I said a similar thing, which is that I'm going to be gone 2 weeks. I don't think more, but you never know. In the event that we need to pull together a committee, Representative Coghill will chair, and I made that offering on Senate Bill 20, and I'll make the same offering to the bill sponsor on this bill, that if time becomes of the essence and if you all can have this opportunity to get with the family law bar and mm-hmm. be certain that we're not overreaching in our intent here and creating more mischief than we mean to, then that bill can come back up before the committee. And so with no disrespect to Representative Cott, we'll go ahead and hold House Bill 414 over.
Through the chair, none taken.
Okay.
And I'll commit to work with you.
I look forward to it, Representative. Thank you.
Okay, let's take a brief at ease. Record 305, we're on our final bill, House Bill 93. Mr. Hilliard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Heath Hilliard. I'm staff to Representative Anderson, the bill's sponsor, and also the proud cameraman for the Judiciary Committee proceedings today for the chair and the vice chair. Before we move on, before I get into this, I just wanted to mention that there is a blank CS for the committee's review, and I didn't know if someone wanted to move that first before I started to address.
We have explanations.
Yeah, version S. Let's Representative Coghill to adopt it for discussion.
Madam Chair, I move that we have before us the CS for House Bill 93, which would be the S version dated 2106.
Okay, is there an objection to adopting it for discussion purposes? Okay, hearing none, we have the S version before us.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, what this bill does, and the version S does not make the sponsor statement inaccurate. What this bill basically does is creates a peer review committee for the board of dentists and dental hygienists to allow members of the profession greater involvement in adjudicatory proceedings before the board. The Alaska Dental Society, and we have several representatives here today to discuss that, can really stress for the committee the value and importance they believe this change represents. To speak to the version S, I did provide a summary of changes, and if you'd like me to, I would go through those very briefly.
Yes, please.
It should be in your packets, page 2, line 30, reinsert or knowingly cooperated in. That is mirrored language elsewhere in the bill, I believe, in page 8, and the Council for the Dental Society believed that keeping the language consistent throughout the bill was of value. In addition, page 4, line 2, insert physically between who and reside. The concern was is that they have dentists who actually physically reside here in the state, not and that the distinction was physically reside, and so that was why the inclusion was made there. Page 4, line 3, the clinical practice. Page 4, line 3.
Okay.
Insert clinical between the and practice. It was also important to make the distinction that the dentists that would be participating in this would be clinically practicing currently. Page 7, line 2, and this may be of committee's interest, is substituting the burden of proof from reasonable substituting reasonable for substantial. There was some concern about the level of evidence that would be required in that circumstance. page 9, lines 8 through 9, strike, or an approved provider of continuing education for dentists. Didn't really know of any organization, group, or institution that wouldn't be covered with dental schools. So it sort of made no sense, and so that's why the Dental Society asked us to have that removed. And lastly, with regard to the fines, they suggested an increased fine structure from 25,000 to 50,000, and that's found on page 13, line 28.
From Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Hilliard, I maybe should ask you this. I'm objecting to the CS. For the purpose of a specific question here, either the dentists or for you, maybe for the dentists. And it's the only question I have, and it's on page, the change on page 4, line 3, the use of the term clinical practice. Because there are other types of practice. I have a friend, Stu Rader, who used to practice forensic dentistry. He lost his arm. And he practiced exclusively forensic dentistry, as you may know. And there may be other people who would have a practice of academic dentistry if they were a professor. And I'm just wondering what other types of non-clinical practice might there be that I'm not aware of? I'm asking them, really.
You could...
you have to identify yourselves.
Sure. Gordon, state your name. For the record.
Hi, I'm David Logan. I'm a local dentist here in Juneau. I'm also legislative chair for the Alaska Dental Society. Okay. Regarding your question, other types of clinical practice or other types of practice other than clinical, there are dentists who choose to occupy themselves, earn a living in other fields, even though they're still a licensed dentist. So that could be you could have a licensed dentist who doesn't actively engage in...
No, because it would say in the practice of dentistry.
A second category would be somebody who's doing, let's say, insurance reviews, for instance.
Would that be considered the practice of dentistry?
Yes, it would be.
What I'm wondering is for any other categories, because if somebody, it seems to me, yes.
Public health dentistry, where they do epidemiological studies, but they haven't seen a patient for many years.
I see.
That's still a practice of dentistry, and you need to be licensed to do those kind of things with human subjects. But they may not have ever touched a handpiece or dental drill for many, many years.
Madam Chair.
I see.
Can we have them come and explain that to us so we can get that on the record? I think that's
important. Yeah, you need to come up, George.
I'm sorry.
Please.
I heard the whole explanation before I realized we better get it on the record.
Yeah. No, you can still stay there.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Schaefer, and I'm a dentist that practices in Ketchikan.
Could you repeat the answer to the question?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
The question was, are there other categories of dental practice that may not be clinical? And one of the categories is public health dentistry. And they analyze epidemiological data, tend to be government employees that have not seen a patient in many years. Oftentimes there's somebody that goes through dental school that finds that they don't like working with their hands, but they still have a dental license and they're able to deal with the decisions that require dental choices, but they're many, many years away from staying current in what's happening on a clinical basis.
They could be dental administrators of some type.
Administrators, yes. And they can work for insurance companies. They could work for government agencies. Some of them are academics in dental school.
Okay.
I understand, Madam Chair, I understand why you want somebody who's actually doing the procedures. I'll remove my objection.
And I could add another category. There are many, many dental school professors that are dentists, but they don't do dentistry anymore. They do research in microbiology, dental materials, quite a number of categories there, but they stay away from patients, and yet they're still a licensed dentist.
Sure.
Just for clarity.
Representative Coghill and then
on
Wilson.
On page 4, line 13, 14, talks about the definition of in practice of dentistry, practice of dental hygiene, have to have an average of 20 hours a week in private clinical practice. So I think we're well within our bounds, but it might be just academic for this bill. So, and I didn't want to hold you up for testimony.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In this state, right now, there, and I think in the rural areas, there's a shortage. There's a problem. We don't have enough dentists out in the, that are willing to go out into those rural areas. And so I think in the native population especially, there are a lot of people that aren't getting serviced at all, that they have problems with their teeth, and there's not enough dentists willing to go out there and work on them because it's not profitable. I think when you were in my office the other day, you mentioned that it wasn't profitable to do that, and so that's not happening. Now, some of the native corporations kind of in self-defense of this to see if they can get services have started sending people down to New Zealand to get a couple years of training so that they can come and start working in these rural areas. And I think you mentioned that some of them are even doing it in not-so-rural areas. But anyway, so would this bill help so that our problem in the rural areas is going to get better?
It will have absolutely no effect one way or another. This bill is strictly regulating the makeup and function of the dental board.
Okay. But when we talked the other day in my office, I maybe misunderstood, but I thought that there was a lot of it that was going on because, I mean, this kind of really was triggered by that practice that's starting to go on out there now.
I'd be glad to answer that. No, this was triggered by a 20-year frustration of those of us that have served on the dental board. I'm a past president of the licensing board, and so is Dave. And for many years, the board has been making decisions about discipline of a dentist or a hygienist without ever seeing a scrap of evidence. We never got to see an x-ray. The way the investigations were done and the reports that came back to us, and we felt that that was unfair, that if we're going to make a decision involving somebody's future, we should see what the evidence is. And so that's where the frustration came out and got us politically active in this process. And it has nothing to do with the DHET consideration that came out. In fact, we got moving on this board before anybody ever went overseas for any kind of training. So they're completely separate issues.
So follow up?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the changes that you would possibly make as a board would not have any effect on anybody in the rural area?
No, this
no one working in a rural area.
The bill strictly is dealing with the disciplinary actions of the board. There's some other minor issues involved, but the primary thrust of it is the disciplinary actions of the board and how the board goes about that process, inserting peer review, for instance, there as a method that they would be able to hear cases. And mostly it just deals with giving the board more insight into the cases that come before them so they can make better decisions than they currently can.
Is there another bill that we were talking about in my office? Okay.
Completely separate, unintroduced at this point.
Sorry.
That was one we brought in the hopes of perhaps being able to get it introduced at some point in time. Absolutely no connection.
Okay, sorry. That's what I was trying.
Other than me.
Okay, anything further you want to add to the record?
I'd like to make just a very...
Can you just state your name again?
Okay, George Schaefer. And again, practice in Ketchikan. I would just like to emphasize that what we want here is we would like the state to be more involved. A good example is presently peer review is only done by dental society members, and if you're not a member of the dental society, peer review is not available to you. And that to me looks like the chickens or the rooster guarding a hen house. It in a way is a good old boys club, and it can look that way to the public. But by getting this bill passed, peer review gets in the purview of the state, and the dental board, an arm of the state, is watching through every bit of the process. And I think that's important to all of our patients, not just dental society members, but those that aren't members. In addition to that, there is a clause in here that allows the dental board to have oversight over drug and chemical dependence or chemical interventions. So that if we have a practitioner out there that the family members, for example, are worried because they think that they're having some kind of dependency, that the board can be aware of that and watch over it prior to any harm being done to a patient. And I think that that's a proactive response that we currently don't have within our Practice Act. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anything further you want to add there?
Nothing from my standpoint, although certainly willing to answer questions if any of the representatives have questions.
Okay. Just I want to put on the record that Dr. Logan and Dr. Schaefer and I were talking with Catherine Reardon, former director of the division, who had to go home to care for her child. And I would hope that you'll be continuing to work with her and deal with some of the problems we, I think, had reached an agreement on, so that a CS can be put on in the next committee. I'm not offering any amendments. We had reached accommodation, but just to be certain that there's enough time, I'm not going to be offering anything today, but I stand ready to assist with the understanding you'll continue to work and get these squared away in the next committee.
I might inquire of Representative Gruenberg of some of the areas that he may
have considered. Yeah, I can go over the stuff if you...
At least the major policy call.
Well, let me just go over there. What they dealt with were timelines that on the disciplinary process that on page 2... And I'll just talk about what we talked about doing. Page 2, line 16, eliminating the word discipline, eliminating subsection E, which contains some difficult timelines in them. Then we move back to page 4 and talking about circumstances where the officer, the president of the board, might not be a licensed dentist, but would have to recommend triage kinds of things, how to deal with it. If the president of the board wasn't a dentist, the board would designate somebody else to make these decisions, which are back on page 10. And we had some proposed language for that, just sort of on the fly. On page 6, line 2, eliminating the word only so that other identifiers could be transmitted, besides the information that's there. Then on page 7, allowing the examination to be conducted by somebody outside the state who's otherwise qualified. We talked, and this was a question that wasn't answered, but Tom Van Fleen, their attorney, could answer whether on page 7, line 26, the court should review the matter de novo or do it on the record, and the application of the Administrative Procedures Act. And then we were over with the conforming amendment on page 10. And we hadn't really gotten all that far with the bill, but it was extremely productive, and we did all of this in about a half hour. And it was just, you know, one thing would be said and everybody would agree, but it just would take a little while to get this stuff together. And if we were meeting, you know, we'd be able to do this with no problem, probably in a couple of days, but not to hold the thing up. They can do that in finance. And if Heath and the other people want, I'm happy to be involved with that. I'm available, delighted to help.
So you're stating dentists are our friends?
You're pulling teeth? To say that, no. Yes, definitely. Hopefully.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. I have two other individuals, or three, that have offered to. If you want your bill to pass sooner, you'll keep your comments brief. I think you might have the support for the bill to move out today, but if we stay here another hour, you might not. So, Mike McGill.
McCrary. will, and I will take that as a threat, and I have no testimony.
Okay.
Are you a dentist?
Robert Robinson.
That was a yes.
Hung up. Jim Towle.
Toole.
Pardon me. Toole. T-O-W-L-E. Mr. Toole? Okay, with that, public testimony is closed, and that brings the bill back before us. Representative Coghill.
Madam Chair, I'm going to follow along with some of the discussion as well, but I would move that we move CS for House Bill 93. It would be the version S version, unamended, from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Object. Actually, I didn't realize we were going that fast.
Okay, there's an objection. Representative Guerra speaking to your objection.
Madam Chair, I've gone through the bill, and I've got some questions.
Okay.
So we have them answered maybe by...
Absolutely. Who do you want to direct them to?
Heath, maybe.
How about who's most familiar with the chair? How about Heath and one of the experts?
Okay. Mr. Hilliard and
whoever can answer it best.
Okay.
They can all three come up.
Whatever you wish.
Okay. Questions, Representative Guerra? Yeah.
On pages 11 and 12, page 11 at line 9, and then 12 at line 19, it talks about the dentist's ability to appeal an unfavorable decision. Does the patient have a right to appeal? I don't see the corresponding right of a patient to appeal if they're the one that loses.
It says a party to the peer review. Oh.
It's in there?
Do you state the...
Well, the one on page 11 says a party can appeal if the decision includes a recommendation for disciplinary action. What if the recommendation is the other way against the patient? Don't they get to appeal?
And it's Dr. Schaefer, and what we read the wording as party refers to both sides on an issue.
But only if the decision includes a recommendation for disciplinary action by the board.
And you would like to add a section that would allow a patient to appeal if the board does not take disciplinary action?
I guess that's what I'm asking.
And we have no objection to that.
Or it could be, it wouldn't necessarily, yes, right. Yeah. Or the division itself could, in proceeding on behalf of the state.
Our purpose, we want this to be an open process. We're not trying to close anybody out. So if that wording makes it better for that purpose, we're very happy with it.
Okay, I'm going to try and move as quickly as possible. It seems like the same problem exists at page 12. It seems like the licensee can appeal, but again, it doesn't seem like the complainant can appeal.
And our response would be the same, keep it open.
Let me run through this as quickly as possible.
And guess who's chairing now? I have the motion to move the bill.
Little power goes a long way.
I can run through this. This is going to take... I'm going to run through this and maybe do conceptual amendments on the fly as long as they... page 2...
Fine with me.
What do you want to do?
Because it's my bill and I'm acting chair, I'll give some latitude. Obviously, of course, it's frustrating because we're at the length of moving it out, and then you want to go back. That's your right within reason, but I don't know how long you think.
It's a 17-page bill.
Well, I understand. But you're unique in that we were all the rest were going to pass, and I mean, I didn't have problems with Representative Grunberg. Why don't you go ahead?
Maybe you were going to pass a bill that. You know, I've just pointed out
that you
big
don't
problems.
Agree with in certain respects. So go ahead and start your amendments. That's fine.
Okay. John, want to say something?
Representative Wilson?
Ms. Peggy.
I just was wondering, Representative Grunberg had some concerns, and they're going to work with him on those concerns. And so why don't you guys get together and you can work on those all together so that it's all rolled into the next, by the time it moves to the next committee? I don't know. I have no idea how serious this is.
I probably have some of the same questions that Representative Guerra has. And so let's bring them up, deal with them as expeditiously as we can, if they're possible. But I was not interested in holding the bill necessarily, but I was going to follow it with some of the same questions, I think.
Why don't you go ahead and we'll just go
Let's look at page 2. It's page 2, line 9. It says that the information is confidential. And I suppose if there's a finding against a dentist or a dental hygienist, does that remain confidential too? It seems like that should be public.
I would ask the doctor to respond, but put in a caveat that, so you mean in the same line as that with the ethics, that remember the dialogue we had yesterday?
I guess if there's a dentist who's performing poorly, I think the public should know.
There is a provision farther in the bill that says that when, after a board takes action, then it is, the public is notified. And we're working with the conceptual to open that up even more so that more details can be added when the board notifies the public. So there's no, this is not making an action of the board confidential.
This is what I would like to do. I'm trying to actually help you, Tom.
I understand. I want your support for sure. I'm not being critical.
I'm thinking about just doing a conceptual amendment that says if the board finds that there's a violation, the information relating to the violation shall be public.
Representative Gruenberg? Yeah, can we take a brief at ease?
Can we just have a brief at ease, please?
I like when you support
it. I could refer you to page 6, line 2. Over in the underlined section, there's a word only that I think that causes some concern, and we've agreed to drop that word. Because only seems fairly restrictive on how much information the public could receive. And by dropping that, it allows the board to notify the public with much more detail.
The problem with page 6, that's just a newspaper notice that says that the board took some action. But beyond a newspaper notice, I think the records relating to what the violation was, I think, should be public if the dentist did something bad. Or the hygienist did something bad.
And we have no intention of purging records or trying to hide something. If the board takes an action against a license, that goes on the record, and in fact, it's reported to the National Practitioner Data Bank.
Why don't we, Representative Guerra, I'm Mr. Guerra, give an analogy of circumstance here, where your amendment would help for public policy.
A dentist does a terrible job, kills somebody because they administer way too much anesthesia. That should be something that future consumers get to find out, right?
Representative Condo?
Sure. Certainly, if a criminal action happens, the people, I think, are probably going to find out. I think what we're talking about here is if the board makes a decision, then that is made known. And because the language typically in statute is it goes through a newspaper, because that has been the typical way that it has been made known before, maybe we need to update our statute to say it's not just newspaper, but in a variety of means of public communication or something like that, because I don't know necessarily that you want to take out an ad, but what you want to do is say through electronic means or newspapers or other publications. And I think that's kind of getting at what you're saying, because in statute generally we have narrowed it down to newspapers because that has been a typical way of notifying people in a broad public sense.
Procedurally, just to be clear, there was a motion on the table by Representative Coghill to move the bill. There was an objection to it. So while the discussion's interesting, it's sort of out of order. Agreed. So the question will be, after Representative Guerra has cited his concerns, does the maker of the motion wish to remove his motion, or does he wish to have a vote, in which case then there'll be a vote on the bill moving out, and the maker of the amendments would make them onto the next committee, or if you wish to remove your motion, then we can make them now. So that's kind of where we sit procedurally.
But Madam Chair, I'm going to
Representative Anderson.
Supplement your observation and your articulation of procedure with, if we, while you were gone, if we do proceed with the amendments, that we do it within a time sensitive. In other words, don't we want to move the bill out today?
Yes.
And I thought we concurred on that. So if you could work with us to that end.
I don't have a problem with removing the motion to move the bill to try to fix some of these.
Well, that puts me on notice then. I will.
I mean, we have the
I
vote,
will withdraw
so
my motion
out.
To move the bill so that we can consider some okay. specific.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg. Amendment.
No.
Okay.
What I had said was I would work with these folks to come up with a CS for finance, and I'm happy to do that. Or if you wished.
That's a fine thing. Do you think you could bring Representative Garrett in the fold?
I'll bring anybody in the fold.
And Madam Chair, I commit to not even asking the schedule in finance. Again, I don't want your opposition on the floor. I want
the
support.
The reason I'm saying this, not to interrupt, but I know these other two representatives are interested in the bill. All four of us are interested in the bill. And if this pregnancy were not here, we would be working on the bill the next few days, all of us as a group.
Well, we won't be here next week, so there'll be not one committee meeting for the next 9-8 days.
Yeah. I'm going to be very frank and lay something on the table. You can kick me out of the room if you like, but and I hope that you had put a couple of bills in Representative Coghill's care to and allowed him to chair on a specific bill, and I'm wondering if you would allow him to take this bill up on Monday or something so we can finish this and do it right.
Yes. I don't feel comfortable with that, Representative Gruenberg, just because of the commitments that I've made. I just think at this stage, first of all, the bill really, it's a very, it's a stretch to have it in front of judiciary, to be blunt. And we have established a precedent of going outside the scope of why a bill's in judiciary. But to really get into all of the stuff, I think if you guys want to continue to work on it, the Finance Committee has an excellent membership of people from across the state, and I think you ought to keep working on it.
I'll just say one thing.
Representative
Gruenberg. I think I can represent that the stuff I was working on would be within judiciary's jurisdiction.
Okay. So are there amendments to the bill? Let's get working on the amendments. What amendments do you have, Representative Guerra?
Madam Chair, I have no intention of not letting this bill out of committee, and actually probably would be smarter to let us work on it next week.
So what's your First Amendment?
All right. Conceptual Amendment number one, Madam Chair, would be on page two. State that at line nine, that when the board finds that there's been a violation by a licensee, that information relating to the violation, including the board decision, shall be public, I guess, except that personal medical records of the licensee should not be public.
I have no objection to that.
Okay. Is there an objection to amendment number one, Representative Coghill? How do you feel?
I would like to see that in writing, but if the sponsor is going to superintend that, I will not object.
And through the chair, Representative Coghill, if you have an idea, I just looked to the dental folks, and I don't think they have a problem at that because it's already published in other venues or mediums. So
the concept
after the violation.
Okay. So amendment number one, there's no objection. So amendment number one carries. Amendment number two, we have time. I mean, please don't feel rushed. We can stay here till. My plane leaves at 7, so if we want to stay here till
then,
that's fine.
That's not.
That's fine with me. I don't want anyone to feel rushed. Representative Guerra.
Just looking for a second. Madam Chair, page 7, line 30.
Okay.
I understand the board's hope to grant, be able to impose more forms of discipline than are allowed right now. But the language in the bill says they can impose another form of discipline that the board determines is warranted and necessary. I don't know what that would be. It could be like $1 million. Could that be?
Good point.
Who knows?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, if you could respond, because that I saw that a while back and wondered, trying to give latitude, but I thought, how far?
I'd like to respond to that two ways. One is, since this is a peer review bill, all the forms of discipline have been developed for more serious accusations. And so this would allow the board some leeway to impose forms of discipline at a lesser level than what is being done now. And if we could refer back to
So you would like to have the discretion to impose a lesser form of discipline?
Well, sure, for peer review. Okay. For example, refund a patient's money.
Yeah.
Or
say that. Why don't we just
pay another dentist to redo the work, those kind of things. And that's not something that the board is able to do at this point.
Okay, they're confined to what? What is listed? Representative Guerra?
I don't know how I feel about that, so maybe somebody else should make that motion.
Yeah, I have a suggestion.
Lesser, maybe through the chair, lesser form of discipline?
I think that I would hope that maybe we could, in this working group, ask Representative Guerra to participate with us so we can really craft these things.
And if you wanted to simply either leave it alone or strike out any reference to it, that's fine. And let you guys come up with, I think you do need to be more specific.
Well, I'd like to interject page 14, line 28, 29, and 30. And what this is wording that would require the board to write out in regulations the kind of discipline for each type of action. And so there is the safety valve built in there that there would be public hearings for regulations. And for these alternate kinds, other forms of discipline, the board would have to have the hearings and go through the regulation process. It's because what this does then is it develops a guideline for all future boards so that they're applying discipline on an equal basis from one year to the next. As it is now, all of this is in policy, and the present boards aren't given a policy packet with history. Mm-hmm. But with regulations, it locks it in very clearly so that the boards are consistent.
Yeah, and I see your point, but I think it probably needs some work. I see your point, which is that really now you just have revocation or suspension, reprimand or censure, and your point is that there are situations arrive where you want some more latitude to maybe impose something less.
And I'm sure, what about stating a lesser form instead of another form?
Representative Wilson just pointed that same idea out.
We would have no problem with that.
Still have it in the working group, so at least that starts.
That's a good start, and Representative Wilson just pointed that too. So Representative Wilson, you want to make the amendment?
I move that on page 7, line 30, we delete the word another and add a lesser.
Okay, so amendment number 2, page 7, line 30, to impose a lesser form of discipline. Is there an objection to amendment number 2? Okay, hearing none. Further amendments. Representative Guerra?
Madam Chair, I move conceptual amendment number 3, which is at page 9, line 16.
Okay.
This section says that you can't discriminate against somebody solely based on a physical disability. That causes me a little bit of concern. What's okay with me is that later on it says the board has to comply with federal law. So I want to make sure they comply with all laws on discrimination. I don't want this to be an out from any laws on discrimination. So what I would say is the board shall comply with federal law and state law, including federal and state laws governing discrimination. I don't want to relax the rules on the laws on discrimination.
But before you move that conceptual, how about with all applicable laws relating to discrimination? I mean, we can put federal and state, but what if there's municipal? I mean,
Sure, federal, rural. State, and municipal, I guess. I was just going to say federal and state.
But how about all applicable?
I think all applicable is too vague. Representative Coghill?
Even the laws of the Bible.
I agree. We may not want them to discriminate because of a disability, but the disability may actually impair them from ability, and I would want to caution us. I think that's what they were looking at in here, is how to deal with somebody who has now become unable to perform under the duties set out as a dentist, clinical dentist. So I think both of those statements can be fair in there. I just want to make sure that we're not saying if somebody has, for example, serious bouts of depression, that really do put them out of the ability to practice.
Where they lose a
that,
hand.
That a disciplinary action that says you're not able to is not a breaking of federal law, because it's a recognition of ability rather than a discrimination of disability.
I think that's consistent. I think the federal and state discrimination laws do let you not hire somebody or terminate somebody's license if they're, for reasons of them being a danger to the public, if they were licensee or something like that.
And when we're looking at this, look up at the starting page 11, because it sets out the fact that the board may not discriminate solely based on and so on. So really the part we're talking about is if you do reach that point, as Representative Coghill says, where unfortunately you have to make a decision that is based on the existence of a physical or mental impairment or disability, then the board shall comply with federal law. Would you like to say shall comply with both federal and state law?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that
federal and state law governing discrimination?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Madam Chair, I move conceptual amendment number 3, which would be at page 9, line 16. The word shall be shall comply with federal and state laws governing discrimination.
Are we keeping the language in on lines 10 and 11?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so conceptual amendment number 3 before us. Is there an objection to conceptual amendment number 3?
Only that I think it's redundant.
Representative
Coghill?
Okay.
I won't object.
Okay.
So finally,
no objection. Amendment number 3 carries. Representative Guerra?
Finally, conceptual amendment number 4 is, Representative Wilson came up with good language on this. I think wherever the licensee has a right to appeal, the complainant, or if the department is bringing the claim, the department shall also have the same rights to appeal.
And that's page 10, right?
And that's page 11 and it's page 12, but it might show up somewhere else in the bill too.
Okay. So the conceptual amendment would be that the rights are equal.
The rights of all parties shall be equal. Wherever it gives the licensee the right to appeal, all parties should have the right to appeal.
Okay, and we had discussion on that earlier. I haven't heard any objection. Is there any objection?
None from our side.
I think we discussed that earlier. So that's the conceptual amendment. So the drafter can look to those places largely on 11 and 12, but where any appeal rights exist, and I think that's fair. It should be both sides.
Madam Chair.
Okay, and so that's conceptual amendment 4. Is there an objection to that amendment? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 4 carries. Representative Anderson.
Just before we move the bill, assuming we've satisfied at least currently Representative Guerra's concerns, I want to extend my appreciation to Representative Gruenberg, because you could have said, now I want to go through my amendments and stay to 7, granted by Representative McGuire.
Let me put an agreement on the record. Let me put an agreement on the record. And this is what I'd like to do. This is part of my not objecting to moving the bill, but I'm not going to object. With the understanding that the dentists and their representatives and the lobbyists and your office and my office and me and anybody else on this committee will meet to continue and come up with a CS dealing with what we dealt with before. And that's part of my non-objection, that we do this, and I'm asking Mr. Hilliard to coordinate that meeting as quickly as possible later today, this weekend, while you gentlemen are available. So everybody who didn't really get a chance to get their oar in can participate fully in this thing.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, in the sponsor's absence, I'll be happy to do that, and I'll make sure that Representative Guerra gets the new committee substitute once it's reported out, the judiciary version, and then we can work off that document to make the changes.
Thinking that it might be, I'm going to have some time now if we want to go back and try to get Ms. Reardon on the phone, so while you guys are here, we can continue to get this squared away as quickly as we can, because we know what Les has done here.
And I like his face. He's like, oh, that sounds good. Tom's looking at me. Inside,
so
he's like.
So we'll go back to Representative Coghill's motion that was withdrawn before. Do you want to restate your motion?
With that, Madam Chair, I would move that we move the CS for House Bill 93 I think it was version S that we started on, right? As amended conceptually.
No, version L.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
With individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and anticipation of further work.
Okay. Is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, House Bill 93 as amended, the individual recommendations has moved on to the Committee of Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Les.
Yep, no problem.
That was only because of...